Shrink Wrap Radio number 483, An Insider's Experience of Psychosis with Shannon Love.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Shannon Love, author of the 2015 book, Twisting My Kaleidoscope, which is a memoir of her experience with psychosis. For more information about Shannon Love, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Shannon Love, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me, Dr. Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I'm so pleased to have you. I've been reading your delightfully written book, Twisting My Kaleidoscope. The style is delightful, but that's probably not a good description for the content, which describes your experiences with psychosis. But before we get into that, let's take a step back. Your husband had some sort of high-level job in a multinational company that had you two plus your three kids living in a variety of countries. Which countries were you in?
We lived in Beijing, China. That's where we were when I had my first psychotic break. And we also lived in Angola, Africa before that. And at one point, when my husband was in graduate school, we spent a few months in Barcelona, Spain. So those are the three countries that we've lived in outside of the U.S.
And before the events in the book, how did that sort of nomadic lifestyle suit you?
Oh, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I would go back if I could.
Okay. Now, you were 42 when you experienced the first psychotic break. And usually this kind of thing happens in the late teens or early 30s. Why do you think yours came so late? And what do you think triggered it?
Well, I do believe that I was probably always hypomanic before my first break. People would describe me at that before then that I was a very high energy, happy person. And as a matter of fact, some of my friends would make comments like, "Oh, why are you always in a good mood? How do you do it? How do you have so much energy to do all of these things?" And of course, it was because I was hypomanic is why I was able to and why I was always happy. I think the reason it never exacerbated into much more than that was because I married well. I married a very gentle, loving, stable man, and I just didn't have that much stress in my life. So because my stress level was so little that it just never reached that. I never crossed that threshold before that point.
But at some point when you were living in China, some stressors began to accumulate.
Oh, yes. It all began in the hospital when I was getting a routine checkup. During my ECG, they became quite concerned and kept me there at the hospital and continued to ask me if I was having chest pains and this and that. And basically that led into a 5-month period of heart testing of my heart and for a heart condition. And that was, that triggered an anxiety disorder.
Yeah. And you had a family history. No wonder it triggered anxiety. Tell us a little about the cardiac family history.
Well, both of my parents have heart conditions. My dad had his first heart attack in his 50s. My mom had a massive stroke at 62, and my brother passed away at 36 from a massive heart attack. So it was very, very real to me.
Yeah, I'll say so. And you were in China at the time, and going psychotic in your home country is bad enough, but I'd think that having it happen in a foreign country would be especially scary. Do you think living outside your home country contributed to it?
No, actually, I don't, because all of the stressors and that led to my psychotic break, my first psychotic break, really could have happened anywhere that I lived. They didn't have much to do with where I was living. They were just circumstances that could have happened anywhere. And also, I suffered two more psychotic breaks while I was in the U.S., and they were equally as distressing. Actually, maybe I think I felt more distressed during those psychotic breaks than I did my first one.
Yeah. So having had three breaks now, I'm wondering if that leaves you feeling kind of like you're walking on eggshells.
Yes, it's my worst fear. I feel like every day that I can remain stable is a victory. And I do worry about becoming psychotic again. And for that reason, I actually avoid certain things like scary movies or violence, anything that has to do with violence or hate. I try to just stay away from and I try to avoid because I just don't want those sorts of things affecting any delusions that I could possibly have if this were to happen again.
Yeah. What about a big part of the content of the delusions was kind of spiritual, religious content. Do you find that you also need to avoid certain kinds of religious/spiritual stimulation or not?
I am a little bit careful with that. I don't like, if I go to, I do still attend church regularly with my husband. This is something that's very important to my husband, is that we attend church weekly, and I love him, so I'm going to attend with him. But I do avoid any place that's a little bit overly charismatic, a little bit just too intense. I have to avoid those sorts of places.
Yeah, because part of the religious delusions that you suffered from in the past were feeling like you were Jesus, things along those lines, right?
Yeah, definitely. At one point during my first break, I thought I was more of a prophet, but I ran into Jesus a few times during my first break. And then my second break, I was convinced that I was some sort of manifestation of God, possibly.
You know, it's interesting that that is such a theme, you know, not just with you, but with other people who've undergone psychoses. That's such a common experience that really one has to kind of reflect on that. But that's, you know, that'll take us a little bit far afield here. Let's stick with your story. You had a very fascinating, I guess you refer to it as, it's an auditory hallucination is how you described it. And I'm referring to Valentino.
Yes, sweet Valentino. Valentino started out as just vivid thoughts in the back of my mind, but he evolved into a character with a personality and a voice. I definitely heard his voice, and we developed this relationship, this intense, intimate relationship, so much so that I don't think I've ever felt that close to anyone in my life as I did to Valentino. He knew me inside and out. And he became my guide. He became my guide, but he also became my lover. It was a very much an erotic relationship as well. And also it was a spiritual relationship, because I thought that God intended for us to be together, and that we were supposed to be together to change the world in some way. And he did inform me. He was the one who informed me that the world was watching me and that the world could, everyone could read my mind and my every thought that crossed my mind. And I was used as some sort of entertainment purposes. And that my husband was part of the whole scheme and that he was kind of a bad guy. And Valentino turned me against my husband. I actually felt like my husband was a monster. And at one point, I even asked him for a divorce.
Wow. Now, this is another thing that happens in psychosis somewhat frequently, is that the voice or voices may start off very benevolently. And in the book, I got the impression that in the beginning, Valentino was giving you very good advice and was being a wise counselor in a way. But then as time went on, did he sort of begin to turn on you?
No, Valentino never turned on me, but he became more controlling over time. I remember changing the way I looked. I remember him telling me not to look any man in the eyes and not to show any affection towards anyone and to kind of keep myself covered and that sort of thing. So I definitely changed my demeanor because of him.
So he was becoming like a jealous lover.
I think so. Yeah, I believe so.
And Valentino, of course, sounds a lot like Valentine, and your last name is Love. Was there any connection for you either then or now that comes to mind?
Well, my secret is that Valentino was not actually his name. I actually gave him another name that I am too embarrassed to tell anyone. So,
now my imagination is racing, but that's okay. I'm not going to press you.
So because of that, I gave him a name for the sake of the book. I did name him, but I gave him the name Valentino, and for poetic purposes, of course.
Right.
I used the word Valentino.
Right. Now, you talked about him as an auditory hallucination, and I wonder, when you say it's auditory, would you mistake him for actually... let's say if you were hearing him and somebody else were in the room, would he have that kind of reality, or would it be a different sort of reality that you were experiencing? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. He was definitely in my head, when people spoke to me, I could tell the difference between his voice and the voices that were coming from other people's mouths. So there was a difference between the two. Yeah.
And what about with later auditory hallucinations? Were there any instances where you would like turn around because you thought somebody behind you had spoken to you?
No, I didn't. But I honestly didn't bother doing that because I just felt like they could see me wherever I was standing, and so why bother turning around? Why bother even opening my mouth?
Yeah, you said there was a period during which you went mute because you felt people could read your mind. So what was the point of speaking?
Yes, that's correct. I just assumed I could have communication with other people without speaking out aloud. So I did. Why waste my breath?
Yeah. And were there any visual or tactile hallucinations?
I did have one visual hallucination when I was in the intensive care unit in the hospital in the United States after my first break. And this visual hallucination, I was lying, just prior to that, I was lying in my bed, and I had suffering from severe cramps in my stomach. And I assumed that those were labor pains and that I was in labor and I was giving birth to something. And when I stood up, once they subsided, I stood up and walked over to the window in my room. And when I looked out, there was a big round circle in the sky. And out of that, just a plethora of little bitty circles just just escaped from it and started falling all over the sky. And I assumed that I had just given birth to a bunch of baby stars. And during my second break, I didn't really have visual hallucinations, but I would have flashes of images, very disturbing images. And so I'm not sure if those would be called flashbacks more than hallucinations.
Uh-huh.
Now, I had a tactile hallucination, which was the most disturbing of all of my hallucinations. And it was the feeling of having intercourse against my will. And I assumed that people were mentally raping me to impregnate me. And it was just a humiliating experience. I hated it. And I couldn't even make myself go near people that I was close to or loved because I didn't want to have that hallucination when I was near anyone.
Yeah. Wow. That does sound disturbing. And anything else you want to say about other delusions that you were experiencing?
Oh, I had so many delusions. There were layers after layer after layer. But I'm trying to think. So let me think of a couple of my delusions. One of my delusions was that, like I said during the second break, was that the world wanted me to be Jesus, that the church wanted me to be Jesus, and that because I refused to be Jesus, the three big powers of our world, which would be religion, politics, and big business, conspired to humiliate me. And what they did was they the voices in my head during my second break just chided me and called me names and said very inappropriate things, offensive things while I was out in public, and made it in my mind sound like the world thought I was saying all of these words and saying using this offensive language. And it was very humiliating. And I thought they had conspired to do that as a punishment because I didn't want to be Jesus.
Wow. Yeah. At what point did others begin to notice that you weren't the Shannon they knew and loved? And then how did that finally end up getting you into the hospital?
During my first break, I was psychotic for quite a while before anyone actually noticed. I would say I was fully psychotic for about a month before anyone noticed. I was very, very good at hiding it for a while. But then I reached a point that I couldn't hide it anymore. And my husband, when I told my husband that I wanted a divorce, he kind of had an idea that something was different and wrong with me, but he was so distraught about the divorce that he was thinking more of ways how he could win me back, ways that he could win me back rather than what's wrong with her. But shortly after that, my sister-in-law came to China to visit me, and she was the wife of my brother that passed away 7 years prior from the heart attack. And I had some really crazy delusions about that, that you'll have to read the book to find out. But at that point, my paranoia had reached to a point of terror, and I had assumed that that China wanted to kill me, that they wanted me dead, and that my husband wanted me dead. And Valentino told me that if I went to the hospital, that the doctors there would evacuate me to the U.S. and I would be safe. And so I pretended to be very ill and to have this pain in my stomach so that I could go to the emergency room. And when they could find nothing wrong with me, I broke down and started crying and said, but if you send me back, they'll kill me. And the doctor then at that point realized that I was in psychiatric distress and called the psychologist in, and they determined that I was psychotic and put me in a room that night. And the next day they transferred me via ambulance to a psychiatric hospital in another part of the city.
And what was it like being in a psychiatric ward in China?
Oh, yeah, that was fun. I mean, in a way, it was kind of fun because they treated me like a rock star. I was the only foreigner in there. And so I was definitely received special treatment. But the women were separated from the men. So the women were in one building and the men were in another building. And we only came together in the courtyard during kind of, I guess, what you could call free time or recess time. You would go outside and get some fresh air. But the women shared, a lot of women shared one room with just many, many beds. And I was in there at first, but then they moved me to a room by myself because I was not doing very well in there. And they thought I would be better off if I were in a room by myself. The people there were very, very warm and gentle with me. And honestly, I think that the folks in the psychiatric ward in the United States and the intensive care unit could learn a little bit on how to treat their patients from these folks.
That was one of the most interesting things to me about the book was that your experience of the care there in China was actually very benevolent. And, you know, the images that I get, that most of us in the U.S. get, come from the newspapers, and they're slanted towards the worst things that are going on in China. But somehow in the midst of that, I mean, it seemed like the attitudes of the mental health workers there in China were very progressive and very humane.
Yeah, they were very humane. Now, I definitely received special treatment because I was the foreigner in there. So I would say that if I had been a citizen, then I might not have received quite that much of much attention. But that being said, it was a warmer environment. It really was.
Yeah. How would you, you said that you actually preferred the Chinese psychiatric ward to the ones that you experienced in the U.S. What was the difference? What's going wrong in the U.S.?
Actually, I did have a positive experience in when I left the intensive care unit at the hospital in the U.S. and I went. They moved me downstairs to less critical care for people that were still needed to. I think they put the severe cases upstairs and they moved everyone else downstairs. And so once they moved me downstairs, that experience was very pleasant. I didn't have any problems there. But the intensive care unit, it was just, they just talk at you. They just treat you. They treated me. I felt like they treated me like I was a child that needed to be scolded most of the time. That's how I felt.
Uh-huh.
And
by contrast, in China,
they treated me like a child that needed to be held and cuddled.
Oh, that's a beautiful way of putting it. That's a beautiful way of putting it. And also in China, they, you know, judging from what you've written, they really worked to remove any sense of stigma that you had about your, being in a psychotic state or having been in a psychotic state. And they sort of totally normalized it, you know, saying, well, you know, your brain is an organ of your body. Sometimes things go wrong with different organs in your body. This is just another thing. Am I putting that right?
That's correct. Yes, that's exactly how we say it to my kids.
yeah. So, and I think there is a kind of stigma here, even among some health professionals. So that just really struck me.
I have to confess, my my therapist in China were actually American.
Oh, were they?
Yeah, okay. They were American therapists. They purposely placed me with American therapists that were there because they thought culturally I would be able to, they would be able to identify with me and vice versa a little bit better.
Yeah. But I do remember interaction with a Dr. Hoy, who was who seemed to have this very gentle approach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was very sweet.
Yeah. Did you experience word salad? Was your speech jumbled up? That, as sometimes happens in psychosis.
I don't necessarily think that I spoke in with like in that specifically in the term of word salad, but I did have problems communicating because when someone spoke, the words would kind of toss out of their mouth and tumble into the air and twirl around a little bit and land in my ear.
Wow.
With a completely different meaning. And because of that, because I was sitting there trying to translate what they were saying, because every word had double meaning in my mind. And trying to translate that was very difficult and very painful. And it actually made me leery of having any sort of conversation with anyone. I really did not enjoy speaking to other people at that point. And then another thing that was a little bit different with me that I think maybe other folks have experienced as well is I thought and spoke in metaphor. One example would be one time with my therapist, Marcia, the one in the United States, I told her about this incident that I had with my statistics professor and how I turned in the project and I thought it was good. And then he basically gave me a bad grade for it. And I wanted to discuss it with the professor and he wouldn't allow me to. He would never allow me to explain myself. I wasn't talking about that professor at all. I was talking about Valentino because during my second break, I still had these strong feelings toward Valentino, but I realized at that point that that was an unhealthy relationship, and I tried to keep him at an arm's length because of that. But that being said, I cared about him, and I thought that I had really hurt Valentino's feelings, and he was very upset that I was not speaking to him, and that he had not given me an opportunity to explain. And that's what I was really saying when I told her about the professor.
Uh-huh. Now, you mentioned you were taking statistics, and I think you were doing a correspondence program hoping to become a school counselor. Do I have that right?
That is correct.
And did that come to pass?
No, it didn't. It didn't come to pass. I haven't returned to school, and I also... I'm going to be honest with you. I guess I'm concerned that how people react with me working with children at this point, because I do have a serious mental illness that leads to psychosis, and some people with this stigma attached, some people are worried about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I can understand why that might be problematic and be a concern. And in part, was it the positive experiences that you were having with your therapist that kind of gave you the ambition to maybe become some kind of a counselor or therapist yourself?
Yeah. My therapist told me that maybe that would actually help me, that I could be more empathetic towards children who suffer from mental illness and kind of be a little bit more understanding of what they were going through.
Sure. Yeah. That can make sense, too. One of your psychologists you refer to as the role master. What were you getting at there?
Oh, yes. That was Marcia. Marcia was my psychologist in the U.S. And shortly after I began seeing her, I suffered from my second psychotic break. And during that psychotic break, I had this experience with her that was I don't know, it was a mixture between transference and a hallucination. You might actually know better than I do. But what happened was she would take on, when every time I saw her, she would take on the personality of another person, someone that I knew or a group of people that I knew, to a point that I thought it was the soul of that person. And even her facial expressions and the way she spoke sounded and looked like that person. Her face didn't morph into the other person's face, but her expressions did, and the way she spoke did. And so each time I saw her, she played a different role, a different person. And it actually helped me a lot, because it helped me approach these people and about the issues and discuss the issues that I had with them without actually having to face them. Of course, I spoke in metaphor most of the time, and most of the issues that I had were based upon my delusions.
Okay. You know, earlier you mentioned that you have a sense of walking on eggshells, you know, not knowing if or when it might have another episode. And so I'm struck by your courage in writing this book, which is very self-revealing. And, you know, what gives you or gave you the courage to take on a project like writing this book?
Honestly, I felt compelled to write it. I started to write the book just before my second break. So I was planning on writing it after my first break, because I thought that was it, that I wasn't going to have any more. And then during my second break, I couldn't write about it, because I was psychotic at the time. I couldn't actually write anything that would make any sense. So I just kept a journal, and I used that journal to help me with my book, so I could look back on the experiences, and I even include some of my journal entries in the book. But the book also gave me something, a goal, something to look toward, to try to pull out of that psychotic break, because that one was a struggle, because I did it without medication.
Talk about medication with all three experiences, what the role of medication was, what your experience of it was.
Okay. My first break, I was put on an antipsychotic, and it was really the only way I could have been pulled out of that break. I was just so far gone the first time.
And which drug was that?
Latuda. I used Latuda.
Okay.
But unfortunately, as I returned to my baseline, I began to suffer from depression, and the antipsychotic was causing me to be extremely depressed, to the point of having not suicidal thoughts, but having thoughts like, I sure wish I were dead, or how long do I have to keep living? Ugh, crap. You know, that sort of thing. So it was, I wanted to be dead, but I wasn't planning on doing anything about it. So
yeah.
It was a terrible feeling, and that's why I actually tried to get off of the medication. That's why I stopped taking it.
So you stopped taking it, but then after you went off, I believe you felt like that being off of it led to the second break.
Don't let me put words
in your mouth if that's not right.
No, I think that if I had been on an antipsychotic at the time, I probably would not have suffered from my second break. That being said, if I had remained on that antipsychotic at that point and there had been no change in my medication, I probably would have become suicidal. So it was kind of a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Are you on an antipsychotic now, may I ask?
Yes, I am. Uh-huh. I have a wonderful psychiatrist who I can be quite open with, And she and I kind of figured out a concoction that works for me. What I do is I take an antipsychotic. I take Abilify now, which is a little bit more benign than some of the other antipsychotics. And then I also take antidepressants. And the antidepressants counteract the side effects of the antipsychotic. And I'm able to be happy and sane at the same time.
Well, good. Now, you haven't talked about your kids, and you have three of them. How old were they during your breaks, and how did they respond to you in that state?
Okay, my kids were 10, 13, 15 at the time, and it was a nightmare for them. It was horrible for them because this person who looked like their mom was not their mom. She was acting in this bizarre fashion, and she was treating their father very cruelly, somebody else that they loved very much. But then they didn't know how to really react to me. It was very, very frightening to them.
I can imagine. And have you been able to heal as a family unit? And what's helped that to happen, if so?
After my first psychotic break, we took a trip to Hawaii, which was very healing. Just being out in the fresh air and near the ocean and just in near nature in this tranquil place and being by ourselves for a little while was very, very healing. I didn't put that in the book because this is such a confusing story that I thought that would be a little bit too much.
Sure.
But also, we weren't able to do that after the second and third break. But also, we talked about it with the kids. We're very, very open about my disease and what I have and what the symptoms are. And we treat it as any other illness so that the kids know that when mom is acting a certain way, it's a result of that she's symptomatic at that time with the disease. And we joke around about certain things. We get a good laugh out of some of the memories because I did some silly, silly things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's nice to be able to laugh about it, but probably what has helped the most is time, is the fact that I've been able to remain stable for over a year now. And that just kind of makes them feel more and more secure. The longer I'm able to remain stable, the more secure the rest of the family feels.
Yeah, I certainly understand that. Did you develop any strategies of your own that kind of help you to come out of these states?
Oh, yeah, I did. During my second break, probably the two things that helped me the most coming out of my second break were writing and research. Like I said, I kept a journal, and one of my delusions was that I had the power to make anything happen simply by writing it down. And so if I had a delusion that I did not like, I would counteract it with writing something in my journal that would just basically say the opposite of that. And I usually wrote in metaphor, so I would have to explain what each of those meant, but it was my way of saying, this is not going to happen. I guess an example would be, because I thought that the world wanted me to be Jesus, I wrote one story about visiting this little town and then inviting me to go to their festival, and the mayor brought me up to the front and offered me a job if I was willing to stay, and I politely declined, and this was really not what I wanted to do. This was not the position for me, and that was my way of politely saying, I don't want to be Jesus.
Yeah.
And also, another thing that helped me was research. I remained lucid enough during my second break to know that I was having trouble discerning reality from fantasy, and I needed to figure out a way to discern the two, between the two. And so what I did was I first I bought a Webster dictionary and I brought it back home and I started writing down the definitions of words that bothered me that I thought had double meaning. And I decided that whatever the dictionary said, that that's what that word meant. And it helped me kind of make that stop translating these words into nonsense and irrational thoughts and be able to look at them for what they really meant. And another thing that I did was I started researching scientific theories to see if it were actually possible for the world to read my mind and or for me to be able to stop it. And I think what these two things did was they kind of steered my mind into a more direct direction, I guess, a more straightforward direction, and made me look at the world in a more literal fashion, which kind of got away from the delusional thoughts that I was having. And I think it did definitely help.
Yeah. So overall, how has your battle with psychosis affected you, and has anything good come from it?
Yeah. Definitely a few good things have happened. Probably the biggest difference in my personality is that I am not as extroverted as I was before. Before my psychotic breaks, I was the life of the party. And now I prefer to be in smaller, more intimate groups now than before. As far as positive results, I would say the family dynamics. The dynamics of my family has changed completely. First of all, there's the relationship with my husband. I always loved my husband very much before I was psychotic. But during this experience, my husband taught me what unconditional love is. He taught me how to love somebody no matter how horribly they treat you and how bizarre they act. And because of that, he's become my world, and I just think he's the sexiest man on earth. And also before my first psychotic break, we had very traditional roles. My husband was the breadwinner and I took care of the house and the family and the kids and my husband was not as involved with the kids at that point. But when I had my psychotic breaks, he had to be involved because I was not capable of it. He had to be the mother, the father, everything. He had to play all the roles. And he and the children became quite close during that period. And since then, it's just remained that way. He comes home earlier now. We spend a lot more time together as a family. He is as involved in my children's lives as I am. And it's wonderful. And then there's my book. That's a very positive experience for me. I mean, I wrote a book about something that I think can help people, and I showed vulnerability that I would not normally do, would not normally show. And so I'm kind of proud of myself for that.
And well, you should be. What do you think professionals in the mental health community might gain from reading your book?
I think that the main thing that professionals can get from reading my book is that they can actually experience what psychosis is. The purpose of my book is to almost put the person even though this actually happened, into kind of a simulation of what psychosis is. That for them to feel the feelings that I had and understand the thoughts that were going back behind my head, going on in my head, and just truly experiencing it. And once you've experienced something, you're definitely better able to identify with someone else who is experiencing it as well.
Right. So what one thing would you like our listeners to understand about psychosis from the client's perspective?
Okay. When someone becomes psychotic, it doesn't seem to them that that they've gone crazy. It seems to them that they have been placed in some bizarre world and everyone else has gone crazy. Mm-hmm. And they're simply, when you, and you might think that that person is thinking irrationally and there's no sense to what they're doing and saying, but actually they are reacting to their delusions and hallucinations in the most reasonable way that they can. But the delusions and the hallucinations in themselves are what are irrational.
Wow, fascinating. Fascinating. Well, as we wind down, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I thank you so much for having me on your show. And I'm happy for anyone who has any questions to email me. Can I put that on the site?
You certainly can.
Okay. They are allowed to email me at slove60@live.com. Or they can go to my website, loveskaleidoscope.com. And I'm happy to answer any questions that they have about my experience.
Well, I really appreciate your being as courageous as you have been and letting us into your inner world in such an open way. So I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave, for having me.
I'm struck by the courage that Shannon has shown both in writing her book and in being willing to do this interview to expose herself even more after only a year since her last break. My hope is that this experience will be part of her healing. She's very brave to face down the stigma associated with psychosis. Another point that stands out to me is the value of antipsychotic drugs for at least some patients. In past shows, we've had guests here who've spoken about the downsides of medication. I think this interview underscores that there are some people who benefit significantly from their use. Also, I've not been a big fan of CBT or cognitive behavior therapy, but in the book, it's clear that the therapist who worked with her most after her first break was using that approach and that it was very effective for her. To me, one of the most interesting parts of her account is her, quotes, love affair with the hallucinated voice she calls Valentino. I believe this voice was an unconsciously split off part of her. So during that psychotic episode, she was in love with herself to the extent of asking her husband for a divorce. For me, this really underscores the Jungian notion that so much of love is projection. That to a large extent, it's the disowned parts of ourselves that we're seeking and that we find magnified in the other in romantic love. It also seems to me that this psychotic break is one of those that might be thought of as a spiritual emergency. There were a number of issues in her life that she had been trying to ignore that finally demanded attention. And as a result of this experience and the support of family and friends and therapy and her own internal resources, I have the impression that she's in a more solid place than before these psychotic episodes intruded in her life. She spoke about how much metaphor seemed to invade her thoughts and speech during these episodes. In fact, I find the prose in her book seems to share something of that same quality. There's a sort of poetic, creative style in her writing. I'm not sure that fully comes through in the introduction to the book, but I'll read it anyway, just to give you a sense of her writing. Although I'm no expert in psychology, I am a master of my own story, a journey from sanity to lunacy and back again. If you are up for this expedition, I will paint you into the consciousness of the psychotic, transiting you through my experiences and existence foreign to the mentally sound. My thoughts will divulge the rationale behind such outlandish behavior. My eyes will unmask taboo symptoms that torment the afflicted, and my heart will bear witness to the distress psychosis renders. Possibly, in the end, you may be able to relate. Empowered with knowledge, a sense of empathy might allow you to connect with the mentally deranged. indeed, of an unhinged lunatic, you may glimpse the punctured soul, a mere human being like you, who has been taken from her safe place and positioned in another world, filled with delusions and hallucinations. Why should you care? Because approximately 1 in 100 people suffer from psychosis. If your social circle extends to that number, then most likely someone you know and care about lives with this disorder. And although the stigma attached to those plagued by this syndrome prevents many from sharing, they wish they could. So in their honor, I will. I now offer my gift to you, a peek through my kaleidoscope. As always, you can order Twisting My Kaleidoscope by Shannon Love by going to the right-hand sidebar on our site and using our Amazon.com widget there. By doing so, you'll also be helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio as well.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Nikki Amaria Sargent, and I wanted to say thank you. I want to say I was a therapist in a clinical practice in a rural community that for many years, and it didn't have, still doesn't have, much in the way of public mental health resources, let alone training opportunities for its therapists. My personal journey led me into analysis, and then analytic training, and finally to be a certified union analyst. My rural colleague supported me in all of this, despite questioning the relevance and the value of what I was doing. I still live in that country or community, though I practice in Palo Alto. Your podcasts have helped me learn the fields of study and persons of amazingly rich research and competence I know I have enjoyed greatly. I've told my rural cohorts about your interviews. This has helped them grow as clinicians, better serve their patients, understand me, and get CEU units without extensive driving and big carbon footprints. I'm so grateful for all your time and efforts to put together quality programming, bringing the treasures of depth psychology into contemporary discussion, and helping weave together communities of kindred spirits. Thank you, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Nikki. I really appreciate your kind words of recognition and support, and I hope others will follow suit. Before I forget, you may be hearing this on Thanksgiving Day if you're in the U.S., so let me wish you and yours a happy Thanksgiving. Remember to practice gratitude and to take deep breaths and not let the holiday stress you out. This is as much a reminder to myself as to you. Because I have family visiting from out of town, I decided to be less compulsive, and I postponed the podcast interview I had scheduled for this week. Because of that, there will not be a new episode next week. We do have one new donor on our honor roll, and that's Robert Pies, or Pies, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, in Germany. Thank you, Robert. On the other hand, I'm afraid there are no new transcripts to announce at this time. If you're someone who volunteered to do a transcript, please get it in to me. It's been a while. You know, my former guest, holistic psychiatrist and psychopharmacologist Dr. Hedaya, has the herbal pain relief product Unflame that I've been advertising in our right-hand sidebar. He gets incredible testimonials via email and message phone. Here's a little clip of a part of one that he recently received on his phone.
I wanted to see about a discount for larger quantities, the greatest stuff I have ever, ever, ever taken. And I don't think I'll ever be without it.
So there's a customer who's so enthusiastic and found it so beneficial that he wants to get it in bulk quantities. So you can call direct to order. Mention Dr. Dave as your discount code and save $5 per bottle. Call 1-619-500-4372. Let me remind you that we have an Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on Shrink Wrap Radio that you can use to order any books you wish, but not only books, but actually anything at Amazon. And you know the holidays are coming up, and you'll be probably purchasing gifts and things on Amazon, and I know many of you already use Amazon regularly to purchase all sorts of things. So if you'll use the search tool in our widget, It will automatically add our affiliate code, and Shrink Wrap Radio will get a small percentage of the purchase. So it's another way that you can help support us. I just got back from doing a presentation on podcasting at the Petaluma Rotary Club. And so that was fun. I only had 30 minutes, but I got to talk about my passion, and it seemed to be well received. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, which I keep telling you is my favorite audiobook service, I have another great recommendation today. I'm referring to the audiobook of American Psychosis, How the Federal Government Destroyed the Mental Illness Treatment System, and that's by E. Fuller Torrey, a well-known psychologist and critic of the status quo. Now, this audiobook is nearly 10 hours in length. I'll play you a little sample.
I don't know why other people write books, but for me, it is a selfish enterprise. I write to answer questions that are bothering me. For many years, I have been appalled to watch the unfolding disaster of services for people with serious mental illnesses. The fact that my sister suffered from severe schizophrenia has certainly accounted for part of my interest. Year after year, I observed the consequences as public mental hospitals were being emptied. It was like watching the effects of a tsunami or a Category 5 hurricane in slow motion. Although I knew what would happen next, I have to rerun the tape in my mind again and again. I worked at the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH, from 1970 to 1976, in the midst of the events described herein. Bertram Brown, then NIMH director, was my supervisor. Although I had no formal responsibilities for the Federal Community Mental Health Centers program, I interested myself in it and visited some centers. Thus, I personally was acquainted with many of the players who were responsible for the program. With few exceptions, these people were intelligent, public-spirited, well-meaning, and dedicated individuals. That fact elicited the question that bothered me. How could so many well-meaning professionals have been so wrong and been complicit in creating such a disaster? This book attempts to answer that question.
So if that intrigues you at all, and you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And if that one's not to your liking, they have more than 180,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is David Gordon from Norfolk, Virginia, at the IASD Dream Conference, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Dr. David Gordon, who was my guest way back on Shrink Wrap Radio number 2, speaking on dreams and the hero's journey. I'll read two of our recent emails from our listener community today. First, we hear from listener Hugo in South Africa, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I'm Hugo Cortese from South Africa. I found Shrink Wrap Radio looking up Dr. Donald Kalshed, so I found your interview with him. Since then, I also found interviews with Dr. James Hollis, my other favorite Jungian. However, he always emphasizes in his books that it remains your own responsibility to live your own life. So doing, he helped me a lot. He has such a nice explanation in one of his books that helped me to realize that. If you respect someone, for example, Jung himself, you discover that the person you admire also has faults and a shadow. You can still admire / respect them. I used to live according to the all or nothing principle in my relationships with other people. I'm glad to report I now am busy learning to accept shadow in myself and others." The actual reason for this email is to thank you so much for the work you do with Shrink Wrap Radio. I've since downloaded the application and listened to a few interviews. I found that I always learn something new. Your interview with Dr. Louis Casalino inspired me to write and say thank you. Kind regards, and that's from Hugo Kotze, not quite sure how to pronounce it, but Hugo, I'm so glad that you have discovered Shrink Wrap Radio and found it to be of such value, and that you're a fan of Jungian psychology, and that you've taken it to heart and used it in your own life, looking at your own shadow and becoming aware of the shadow in others and your own projections, I guess, shadow projections on them. So stay tuned. There's lots more that will be coming your way, plus a lot of shows in the archive that would be particularly relevant for you. And I want to read one from listener Janelle, who actually left this in the comments area about episode number 478 with Suzanne Maiden on opening to being a spirit medium. Janelle wrote, "This was wonderful. Thank you. So great to hear Suzanne's voice again on the internet. I wonder how many counselors also possess these gifts. Would seem that many are highly intuitive and empathic, which also makes them wonderful therapists. I will be following her path into spirit mediumship. Seems she can help even more people now with these gifts." So, Janelle, thank you for posting those observations, and you, along with others, particularly appreciated that interview. And so I think we'll wrap it up with that for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments, as Janelle did, about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Shannon Love, for so courageously sharing her journey through psychosis. My next guest will be Dr. Julie Gottman, who, along with her husband, Dr. John Gottman, has co-written the new book, 10 Principles for Doing Effective Couples Therapy. In more ways than one, these two wrote the book on couples therapy. So this is not to be missed. So I hope you'll join us next time. And in the meantime, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.